Good morning.
I love this event. Every year, I get re-energized spending some time with all of you. So I appreciate the invitation to come back again, Mike and Tim. And I appreciate all of you being here. Look, I don't need to tell you, these are some challenging times. Margins in the industry aren't great. Ethanol is selling 80, 90 cents below gasoline today. And old crop corn is ticking upwards every time a speculator decides he wants to enter the market. So it's ever more important that you gather here today, because you're the people that make the juice. You're the people that really need to squeeze every drop of profitability from the plants that you're operating. So an event like the Fuel Ethanol Workshop, which gives you an opportunity to look at new technologies, to see how you might be able to improve the efficiency and profitability of your facilities, is critically important. Over the last couple of years, the way this industry has embraced some new technologies, whether it's corn oil extraction or combined heat power or some of the other technologies that are the difference between profitability and not today, is remarkable. But it's the way this industry has always been. You people have always embraced new technologies. And you're going to need to do that, to find that edge, to keep profitable, to keep competitive into the future. Things aren't great. They will get better. When I talk to farmers today, and they never really want to talk about what their crop is like, but you can tell that we are looking at a big crop. Things will get better. It's getting there. This is going to be a challenging up and down summer, but we will get there. Now, some have said that the reason things are challenging is because we no longer have the tax incentive, or because the industry has overproduced. Well, quite frankly, the way I looked at it, the industry wasn't really taking advantage or receiving the advantages of the tax incentive in any case. The oil companies were seizing that and running with it. And this is not a question of did we overproduce or not. It's a question of demand being somewhat artificially constrained. And our challenge in D.C., but the challenge for the industry, is to be maximizing those demand opportunities. And I'm going to talk about some of those. First and foremost would be the export market. If it were not for the fact that last year we exported 1.1 million gallons of ethanol, the industry would be in very tough shape today. The existence of that export market has been critical to the industry's success. We're exporting to Canada, to Europe, to Brazil, and my favorite, we are exporting some ethanol today to the Middle East. United Arab Emirates is a very good customer of U.S. ethanol. So those oil sheiks driving around on U.S. ethanol somehow just warms my heart. Now, as those export markets have grown for us, some folks don't like that. The European Union has challenged the U.S. industry and filed a anti-dumping and countervailing duty claims, which I think we will win, and we'll hear of that probably in September of this year. We are fighting that strongly. They have suggested that exports are benefiting from the tax incentive that no longer exists. And even when it did exist, the tax incentive really could only be claimed by blenders here in the United States. And while there may have been a marker or two that figured out one way to circumvent that, I can assure you that the lion's share of ethanol that was produced and exported was not receiving the benefit of the tax incentive. The more critical issue that was driving some exports, though, was the European Union's own duty structure. They had a duty structure that encouraged E90 blends. that gave importers a much lower duty rate than for ethanol or for gasoline if it was blended in E90. Not something the U.S. ethanol industry could control at all, but something that they could most certainly do something about. And earlier this year, they did in fact limit E90 blends, and they brought it down to E70. At a hearing 2 weeks ago in Brussels, that issue came up again, and the European Union investigators were questioning the U.S. industry about, well, aren't you just going to start selling E69? Well, whether or not the industry does or not, that's sort of not our problem. Europe has to fix that. The bottom line is, our tax incentive, which they objected to, has gone away. The import tariff system in Europe is something they can fix. And I believe strongly that the U.S. is going to prevail in those disputes, and that the export market will continue to grow and continue to be an important element of our profitability. Now, I believe the single most important factor in our growing export market are not those kind of issues. It's simply that the United States is today the low-cost ethanol producer in the world. I tell people that in Washington, and they look at me like I'm from Mars, because they all believe that somehow Brazil, they've got to be the low-cost producer. That's what Bill Clinton always told us. No. Since 2009, the United States has been the lowest-cost producer in the world. You people have figured out ways to be able to improve efficiencies, to lower your costs, such that Brazil can't compete with us today. Now, part of that is most certainly the rising price of sugar. But I don't see the world price of sugar getting to the 12 or 13 cents a pound that it would need to for them to be competitive with us again. Brazil has sort of recognized this, despite years of pious talk about how they don't subsidize their industry. They are doing everything they possibly can to throw money at the sugar industry, to throw money at the ethanol industry now. They are building export pipelines, and they are providing tax incentives for investment in the sugar and ethanol sectors. And they're targeting their export markets, because just a few years from now, the investments that they've made in oil production offshore in Brazil are going to start actually producing some oil. They have refineries that they're building in the country that will start producing some gasoline, and they're going to want to be exporting more of their ethanol. But I think the U.S. is going to continue, even then, to be the low-cost producer. Our own regulations, unbelievably today, actually encourage Brazilian imports, because California, and to a lesser extent EPA, has given an environmental subsidy to Brazilian ethanol, and it encourages U.S. refiners to utilize that product before they use your juice. That's absurd. And what it means is, because Brazil can't supply their own demand if they're exporting, we're exporting to Brazil while we're importing these products. And these ships pass in the middle of the ocean. It doesn't make any sense for consumers. It has no environmental benefit, but it's one of those regulatory things that we just have to deal with. As long as the U.S., though, is a low-cost producer, the export market is going to continue to be there and going to continue to grow. The fact that we have to, though, rely so much on that export market is somewhat frustrating for an industry that was conceived and built on the premise that we would be adding to domestic supply, that we would be creating jobs here, that we would be lowering the consumer cost of gasoline here. We would much rather sell our ethanol here than abroad. But, as you know, we have been constrained by a regulation created in 1979 to 10% of the gallon. And we have worked hard to open that E15 marketplace to get beyond that E10 cap. And I can report to you that I think on that score, we may be making some progress, and as yet this week, we may see some very exciting news that will allow E15 to be commercialized quite soon. This has been a long and arduous road, as Christy Moore can certainly tell you. When EPA announced that they would allow E15 to be used in only 2001 and newer vehicles, that set us on a course to try to make lemonade out of the lemons that EPA had given, because we believe the data suggests that E15 could be used in any vehicle on the road today. But in an abundance of caution, and largely because the agency couldn't do a full life cycle test on vehicles from the 1990s or 1980s, they only had test data for 2001 and newer vehicles, and so that's what they went with. That's still 60% of the vehicles, maybe 70% of the fuel that's being used today. So we've been pursuing that with great vigor. The first thing we had to do was complete a rigorous set of health effects tests. In February, the EPA approved that testing that Growth Energy and the RFA had done together. EPA then required a very detailed misfueling mitigation plan to make sure that nobody that had a 2000 Honda wouldn't use E15. And it required the industry to put out a plan that would prescribe how the labels would go on the pump, how the product transfer documentation would state that this is E15 fuel only available for 2001 and newer vehicles. It required the industry to put out a broad-based consumer education program and a website so that we could be educating people, and a whole program to make sure the consumers were informed of what vehicles could utilize these fuels. And it required a survey, a national survey, so that the agency and others would know exactly where E15 was going to be used. Now, in EPA's regulation, they said the cost of the survey should be borne by both ethanol producers and refiners. Well, you know the refiners aren't terribly interested in working with us to commercialize E15. So once again, the industry stood up and said, the heck with it. We want this opportunity out there. We'll fund the whole thing. So now, $2.5 million later, that survey is funded. EPA has approved it, and they're ready to go. The agency has approved the RFA's misfueling mitigation plan. We have gotten that out to the industry. The industry has registered for the sale of E15. The only thing that is remaining is EPA needing to approve the marketers seeking approval for EP15 to actually market the product. Now, over the last month, the agency threw one last hurdle at us. They did not approve any of the registrations from gasoline marketers until we had resolved how to deal with the one-third of a gallon of residual fuel remaining in the hose at the pump. Now, I can't make this stuff up. Never in the history of the EPA or the Clean Air Act or any regulatory body looking at fuel regulation has there been a single concern uttered about the one-third of a gallon that remains in that hose after a fill-up. But because the opponents of E15 will leave no stone unturned, they forced EPA to take a look at that, and they said, well, if right after somebody has filled up their car with E15 because they had a 2007 vehicle, somebody in a 2000 vehicle pulls up to that same pump and he only wants E10, because there's a third of a gallon of E15 left in that hose, they're going to have E11.5 if they get one gallon. And you know how many times people drive up to the pump to get one gallon of fuel, right? This is the level of detail that we've had to deal with this agency. But because the E15 issue is so important, rather than tell EPA what we wanted to tell them, I don't think Christy told them what she wanted to tell them, we worked with them. and we came up with an addendum to our misfueling mitigation plan that should hit the streets this week that deals with it. And essentially, for dedicated pumps, no problem. For a pump with E10 and E15 being distributed from a single hose, EPA wants another label that requires a minimum 4 gallon purchase so that nobody can pull up and just get a single gallon of fuel and have an illegal blend in their minds. Okay, so we'll deal with that. For pumps that they're also going to be distributing E85 in addition to E15 and E10, and there will be some of those, it becomes a little bit more complicated, but we think we've got some pathways to allow sales out of those pumps as well. And we really believe that, if not today, tomorrow, but certainly this week, EPA will begin to approve gasoline marketer registrations, relying upon the RFA's misfueling mitigation plan, and allowing the sale of E15 then to commence. We've not ended there. Obviously, there's a great deal of education that has to occur for gasoline marketers. And the RFA put together a very complete E15 retailer handbook, which we have distributed to tens of thousands of gasoline marketers across the country already, and ethanol producers. We have them at the RFA booth at the trade show, and I encourage you to stop by and pick those up, because this is going to be the Bible for how a gasoline marketer can legally and safely and appropriately sell E15. It's going to happen. It's not going to be a huge demand increase anytime soon, because the major refiners are still fighting us at every turn. There's a lawsuit that is ongoing. We'll probably hear sometime in September or October whether or not EPA had the authority to bifurcate the rulemaking in the way that they did, although the lawsuit will likely turn on the issue of standing. And on that, I do sort of scratch my head as to why the Chicken Council has a concern or an interest in a litigation over fuel policy. They're not injured by this, and I don't think the court buys that either. And I would suggest the court very well may throw that lawsuit out, because they should determine that there has been no harm, and the lawsuit should go away. But they're still going to fight. They will fight with Capitol Hill. There continue to be hearings and dear colleagues and speeches on the floor about the perils of E15. And increasingly, they utilize studies that the oil industry have funded that just make no sense. One that was released a couple of weeks ago was based on 8 cars handpicked by the oil industry, 2 of which were under recall. Now, you can't find a scientific body any place in the world that would say, oh, yeah, that's a good, solid scientific test. You're going to utilize a vehicle that's under recall, and then when the part that's under recall breaks, you blame it on ethanol? Really? When the vehicle's also failed on straight gasoline? You don't hear about that, though. None other than the former chairman of the House Science Committee took to the floor last week and was extolling the virtues of this oil industry-funded test program as demonstrating so clearly how EPA had screwed up and E15 is not ready for the marketplace and it's going to cause death and destruction all across the country. And here you've got this 8-vehicle test with 2 vehicles under recall. And he's ignoring a test program that the Department of Energy had done, in which they tested 80 vehicles, in which they had driven those vehicles 6 million miles or more than 12 trips to and from the moon. That apparently is not good science. We're going to rely on this oil industry stuff. The oil industry will do everything possible to keep E15 from happening. Prepare yourselves for the next couple of weeks or months as E15 is trickling into the marketplace for lots of studies about how E15 has destroyed my radiator, how E15 is making my windshield wipers go at twice the speed. Again, I can't make this up. 2 weeks ago in Pennsylvania, there was a news story about a woman who would drive 40 miles to and from a gas station offering E-Zero, because since the time that ethanol had been introduced in the state of Pennsylvania, she's had to replace a radiator twice. I can't explain how the fuel touches the radiator. If it did, she's got worse issues than E-50. But this will be the kind of story that you will see, the misinformation that you will hear. And it's going to be up to all of us. And I think we're going to be employing the resources of the Ethanol Answer Man once again to explain to people how E-15 isn't going to hurt your radiator. And E-15, one fill-up can't destroy your fuel pump. But brace yourselves, because it will be brutal. And we are going to have to be ever vigilant for when this occurs. The most important challenge that we have right now, though, is this with respect to the renewable fuel standard. Senator Klobuchar referred to it this morning. The oil industry is intent upon repealing, modifying, undermining the RFS in any way that they can. They have filed suits against EPA on the RFS, which I believe they will use. They have been on Capitol Hill explaining to people how the RFS was flawed policy, how it's really not working, and how they need to repeal it. It's like the world has turned upside down. A couple of weeks ago, Charlie Drevna, the president of the National Petroleum Refiners Association, NPRA, I know they changed their name. It's always going to be NPRA to me. Charlie will never change either. But he's writing for the refiners in the Atlantic Constitution an editorial that's saying, we have to repeal the RFS because it's taking 10% of the gasoline market from U.S. refiners. I'm sorry. That's what we want to do. We want to reduce our dependence on oil for a whole host of reasons. But Charlie Drevner, in his infinite wisdom, is blaming ethanol for closing refineries along the East Coast. The fact that East Coast refineries are using Brent crude instead of West Texas crude, and there's a $15 or $20 difference in the basis, has nothing to do with their profitability. It's E15. It's ethanol. The world has just gone insane. If there is ever a program that the United States has had to make this country more energy secure, to create economic opportunity in rural America, to clean the nation's air, to address global warming, it's the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard. In 2005, when the first RFS was passed, we were 60% dependent on imported oil for our liquid transportation fuel. 60%. Today, Senator Klobuchar cited the number, we're just 45% dependent on imported oil. That's a huge success. Now, the oil guys say, oh, that's not ethanol. That's the fact that we are now able to get more unconventional oil from North Dakota, and we're able to get more energy supplies from fracking. It's not ethanol. It's the fact that we're producing more domestically than we ever have. And indeed, it's true that this year we are producing more domestic oil than we have in the past, largely because of North Dakota and the Balkan fields. But consider this. 80% of the increased liquid transportation fuel produced in this country since 2005 is ethanol. It's not Balkan oil. 80% is ethanol. The reason we have reduced our dependence on imported oil from 60 to 45% is the RFS. It is ethanol. It is the fact that you folks have been able to make the juice that has made this nation more energy independent. In the dictionary, next to unmitigated success, should be a picture of this industry, your plants, and the RFS. We cannot allow the oil industry to undermine that important program, and they will most certainly try. Recently, we had all of our producers in town meeting with members of Congress, wearing buttons, don't mess with the RFS. Again, visit our booth in the trade show and pick up one of those yourselves, because we constantly have to reinforce the message that this has been an important program. We cannot allow it to be changed. The oil industry has gotten their senator from Oklahoma, Senator Inhofe. Not a big surprise that Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma is not an ethanol fan. And he's created this study group in Washington, D.C., looking at the renewable fuel standard. Supposedly not for legislative intent, but just to better educate ourselves as to what this program is all about. Sure, Senator Boyle. He wants to do a seed-to-wheels analysis of ethanol. Let's really see what all the impacts are going to be. And I sort of scratched my head. And I said, well, if we're going to do a seed-to-wheel analysis of ethanol, that's fair enough. How about the war-to-wheels analysis of oil? We need to put this debate back in perspective. There is a reason that Congress passed the RFS in 2005 and extended it in 2007. It is because, gosh darn it, we're sick and tired of having to send our best and brightest to the Middle East to defend the free flow of oil. Gosh darn it, we're sick and tired of the environmental consequences of our dependence on imported oil. And wouldn't it be a good thing if we were producing more of our energy here? If we're creating economic opportunity in Minnesota, in South Dakota, in Iowa, in Illinois, in Indiana, in Ohio, sure. That's what the program has done. The oil industry doesn't like it. Well, we can't let them steal this program from us. The debate about the RFS, I'm going to tell you plainly, is probably, though, less about the 15 million gallons of grain-derived ethanol that we're producing today, will produce in the next couple of years, as it does the cellulosic ethanol gallon that really scares the ever-loving bejeebus out of it. We are now 10% of the nation's liquid transportation fuel. We are a tremendously successful industry, one that's responsible for some 400,000 jobs, one that added $56 billion to the gross domestic product last year, one that has displaced the need for some 450 million barrels of oil a year. But they can't see a future where the evolution of this industry continues and it's no longer 10% of the barrel that they are losing, it's 25% or 30% or more. They need to stop the progress that the people in this room have made now, before cellulosic ethanol is commercialized, before that becomes a reality, before that becomes an industry that can no longer be stopped, as this industry is. I believe it is critically important for the continued evolution of this industry, for the continued success of the renewable fuels policy, for cellulosic ethanol to be successful, to be commercialized. There are now four plants that are under construction. I think we are going to see commercial production in the next 2 years. The oil industry then has a 2-year window with which to try to stop this program before we can demonstrate the success of the RFS. They will try to assure that the tax incentive for cellulose is not extended this year. We need to make sure that it is. They're going to try to alter the sailors and ethanol targets in some fashion. We need to make sure that those targets, while very aggressive and not being met today, stay as a driver for the financial community so that we are sending a signal that we are serious about reducing our dependence on imported oil. We are serious about commercializing these new technologies. I'll tell you, we cannot crack ourselves to energy independence. The only way that we can do it is with all of the above. That's grain ethanol, that's sales of ethanol, that's other advanced biofuels, that's other energy technologies. Too often in Washington today, the all of the above energy proponents are really talking everything under. It's all that petroleum under the ground that they want to extract. And they forget somehow that we have created, you have created, a tremendous industry providing unbelievable environmental, economic, and energy benefits for this country above the ground. We need to make sure that they're focused on everything. It's a challenging time in the industry. I can tell you it's a challenging time in Washington, D.C. as well. The pendulum swings. I have been privileged to work for this industry for more than 25 years. And I have seen the pendulum swing. I have seen the political environment in D.C. be as toxic as it is today. But I have never seen the grip of big oil around the Capitol as tightly wound as it is today. The amount of money that they are spending on advertising, the amount of money that they are spending on lobbying, the amount of money that they are spending to spread misinformation about our industry is unlike it has ever been. We, though, have got to fight back. And I know that we will. We will not be discouraged by the money that they will spend. We will most certainly not be cowed by the intimidation of their lawsuits or their political shenanigans. And we will not be misled, nor will we allow the American people to be misled by their misinformation. We are going to come together. We are going to defend the RFS. We are going to assure that this industry continues to grow and evolve because of the innovation that you will show at the plant and because of the passion that we will bring to Washington, D.C. to remind them of the importance of this growing industry, the importance of the RFS as a policy, and the importance of the continued evolution of this industry. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep producing the juice. Keep building in efficiencies in your plants. Because we ain't going away. We're just going to continue to grow, continue to provide the benefits that we do for this country. That's the answer, Mr. Johnson. Thank you.